Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain Talent podcast. I'm your host, Shuf Fauzdar, Head of Training and Development at Alcott Global. I'm excited to have Dylan Chung as our guest today. Dylan is the current Vice President, Human Resources for Adidas Southeast Asia, as well as Commercial and Global Functions for its APAC headquarters. Prior to this role, he was the Regional Vice President, Human Resources for Sephora Southeast Asia, where he successfully developed people and organizational capabilities to enable Sephora Southeast Asia's hypergrowth, including leading the digital and omnichannel transformation over 10 countries, as well as opening of new markets. Before Sephora, he was the Director of Human Resources of Starwood Asia Pacific Hotel and Resorts, then Starwood's largest international division across 17 countries in Asia Pacific. There, Dylan led Starwood APAC to become an employer of choice with more than 25 awards and accolades won. He was also recognized by Workforce as a game changer in 2015, an award that represents some of the best HR practitioners and strategists dedicated to pushing the profession forward with innovative people management practices. Wow. Now that is an exciting career journey, Dylan. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Shuf.
Great. A very warm welcome to our audience as well. For our viewers who are listening to this as a podcast or watching this as a recording, we would love to hear from you as well. Please reach out to us on LinkedIn. So now let's get into the conversation, Dylan. You have had a very fascinating experience being on both sides of acquisitions, leading the HR function. You were with Starwood APAC when Marriott acquired them, and then you were with Sephora when they acquired companies to up their game and become the best omni-channel beauty retailer in the world from a bricks and mortar model. So share with us the experience on being on both sides.
Sure. Both experiences were unique for me because specifically with both a merger and acquisition, nothing beats having at least one experience and being on either side. With the Starwood acquisition, Starwood was among the global top five, with Marriott clearly being the biggest. So you were looking at two giants when the acquisition took place. So Starwood was acquired by Marriott. And Sephora was very different. Sephora was where I had the different experience of being the acquirer, and in this case, the organization which was larger and acquiring a digital startup, back then known as Webzola, and then followed the business. I think what was really interesting was the perspective of having been on both sides. And I think when you look at it from an HR perspective, I went into such experiences clearly prepared and having understood what you could refer to from prior experiences before. Look, I would have read case studies and been in business school where we talk about the beautiful stories around mergers and acquisitions that go well, but at the same time, you hear horror stories about when they don't go well. I mean, case in point, there are a couple of organizations that we know where they were big global brand names, and when their acquisition was done, eventually what was intended fractured eventually. So I went into this at least having a sense and understanding of what's going to happen. But I suppose my own personal learnings have been solidified having done both now. One of the most important learnings I had is an understanding that when you have two different organizations, there will always be very different org cultures. And you could be coming from the same industry. And I think when we say organizational culture, it's such a soft, amphibious concept because it's about describing the way it feels to be in a space and how things are done. And we've already clearly know that, you know, the whole concept of how culture beats and eats strategy for breakfast, you hear that, and I personally witnessed it. And so case in point, say, if you look at Starwood and Marriott, both are hospitality companies, they're giants, and a sense of ethos around service, very similar. But the way things are done are clearly very different. And nothing was as different as my experience in Sephora. So one is a global house, Sephora. I think when people see Sephora, they understand, and you can remember and understand and recall from a brand DNA perspective. You've been in a Sephora store, you know what it is like. And Sephora wanted to speed up its capabilities and had gone out and acquired a startup this part of the world. And so when you say startup, case in point, and I know I might be stereotyping, but it is gritty. It's about getting things done fast. there are no protocols and you're extremely experimental. Mm-hmm. It's also very casual and people go straight up to one another, and it's about a spirit of being the challenger, of getting things out there fast and quick. And the exact opposite may not exactly illustrate Sephora, but obviously when you're a certain size, you have processes, carry a certain image, etc. And for me, what's good and important is to then understand that there's no one culture that beats the other. So there's a surprising learning for me. I would have always assumed that the bigger you are, the more you have, as I say. Actually, it's about the capabilities that you want out of a merger and acquisition, mm-hmm. and the culture that is needed to support that acquisition that's more important. So Sephora is fast and agile and innovative, but I think if you compare that to, say, a startup, clearly that's very different. And there will always have questions about, well, if we are the acquirer, we should have our culture being firm and that should be the way it's working. But my learnings have been that sometimes the speed and agility and the ability to just fail fast, test, try, which you mm-hmm. essentially in a startup, almost became the ethos moving forward. And so it completely dispelled the myth I had, which is the bigger you are, the more you get to decide. Completely wrong. And I reframed it into understanding the capabilities that you want, and clearly you buy an organization because you want to have certain capabilities, and it comes with it a certain sense of size. Nurturing the culture that enables that is key. And it's not just about the people, because I think one of my clear biggest learnings when I was in Sephora is understanding that leaders are the ones who set culture. Mm-hmm. And sometimes leaders through an acquisition are put into positions, and very little time is spent in ensuring that the leadership team is put in place, nurturing the right and aligned culture before it gets cascaded. And having said that, sometimes you don't need leaders that are brought in to define a culture, because even in the absence of a leader, there is an existing culture being put in place. So how do you manage that? And this is where I was completely surprised. So I went into both thinking, oh, there's a technicality of this, there's certain functional skill sets I'll pick out of it. And lo and behold, the chief culture officer role came to light. It was so important, because where both mergers and acquisitions were successful is where eventually, over time, there was a prevailing culture that suited what the organization wanted to. And culture takes time to foster and nurture, but culture is set the mm-hmm. moment you start something. So a very small concept, but became very big in my own personal learnings.
Wow. So the importance of setting the culture, not based on who's acquiring, but, you know, what's the capability you want to bring about. And look, I love Sephora. I think they exemplify the whole try it before you buy it concept. It works for people. It works for noobs in the whole beauty and skincare. And I think that's the big pull of Sephora. And it's commendable that even though they went into the whole e-commerce omni-channel, they have their app, you can still use that function because they have that inbuilt. They did not lose that. So I think that was amazing the way they transitioned. So I'm curious to know, what were some best case practices that made integration smooth for you as someone leading the HR and people functions, while also being an employee whose company was first being acquired and then another company which was acquiring a new capability and a new company?
I can bring up 2 points. Let me speak to the whole question as an employee first. Mm-hmm. I think in this case, I was an employee and I was in a position of privilege because I was a leader appointed to sort of drive the entire integration. But let's be clear, as senior as you are, there's always going to be something inside of you that's wondering what's truly the end destination. And I think this mm-hmm. speaks to the concept of change management and transition, right? And you could be a leader too, but I think internally, we all have a compass too. And I think it's about aligning your internal compass to the compass of the organization. And I do not want to naturally assume that once the bells and whistles are done and 3 or 6 months down the road, that everything else is done and signed off. It's not exactly the case, because I think people sometimes underestimate how long it takes to fall in love and sometimes to fall in love again with the new organization, your ethos, your culture, your leadership team, and your new team members. It takes time. And so one clear learning is to make sure that, you know, you really over-index and make sure that people are bought in. Interactions, if you think are needed on a monthly basis, then maybe it needs to be accelerated. Check-ins, ambassadors at a leadership level, and making sure the leaders are aligned, because I've seen too many integrations where leaders are saying something when they're not supposed to be. Or mm-hmm. when employees have water cooler chats by the side, and that's essentially the truth of the matter. So I think ensuring that you have a good pulse of what's happening in the organization, and ensuring that you don't take for granted that people are emotionally and mentally along with you in the journey is key for me. And the other piece for me as a head of HR was clearly making sure that pre-acquisition and post-acquisition, that you ensure that you have all the necessary data that you want. Because look, to be fair, in an acquisition, you do show up the best part of both organizations to say, hey, this is going to be an intended marriage. But like any, I suppose, marriage, or in this case, a relationship, you get to see the ugly part of it after acquisition. And I've been in a situation where I had assumed and thought that this was the case. And then I started to uncover like, okay, this is missing, this is not available. And you go into either a panic mode or you start to wonder how you need to scramble and get things done. So I think the whole adage of planning is going to be a little bit difficult here, because obviously pre-integration, you're not necessarily required to show up and share everything.
Yeah.
But an HR person sometimes is to perhaps set aside enough of your mind space. And I would say keep close to 25 to 50% of a mind space blank and a priority to be able to take on any emerging things that come your way that you don't plan for. Because I plan. And then sometimes as you plan, you forget to plan for space, for anything that you know is or that's unknown. And I think post-integration, there's always going to be something that catches you off guard that you didn't plan for. And I think the ability to set aside your own mind space, as well as set up the organization and people, and furiously then saying, these are the three things that we want to do, these are the three things that we want to measure, and this should be the three things that people say throughout the whole year, is just so important to me. So two examples I could share.
Great. Look, I really liked when you talked about, you know, how for the acquisition, it's very important to keep close to your people, have check-ins regularly, because, you know, whether when I was an executive search consultant or career coach, a lot of time you would have these senior level people who had no idea of what's happening. They don't get communication happening. And, you know, an acquisition and merger is just uncertainty. Even if they know what's going to happen, they don't know how things will play along. So the fact that you mentioned that, you know, the culture piece is very important. It is critical from a people perspective, and then keeping close to the people, having the right messaging. I think when you touched on that, sometimes leaders end up saying things they are not supposed to be saying can have such adverse effects. So thank you for sharing that. We are actually getting a lot of questions from our viewers today. So right. I'll pick one of them. I can't see the name of the person, unfortunately. So the question is, how do you consciously influence culture? What are some of the practical things to do from an organizational perspective?
I'll give one clear example. And I always do this even when I'm facilitating sometimes. So if you put me in an executive development session, and I've done this experiment before, and you know how when you go for some external workshops, day one, you have place cards or name tents, and they're placed, and then people just naturally find out, oh, this is where I'm going to sit, and then they go there. Day two, you do the same, people go there. Day three, you remove the name tents, people end up going there, even when they know. So be very mindful about things like signal. When you have meeting rooms, so who sits at the head of the room, or who gets invited, or even in an email distribution list, who gets access to information, etc. As much as we are not saying anything, we're quietly signaling something. And so to be completely conscious is clear. So there's some things where I've done where you know how town halls are, where consciously sometimes, and look, and I might be saying the wrong things, but you look at some of the world best keynotes or town halls, the leader is in front on the stage and the rest of the people there, you're saying something, but that person is in a position of more importance. And I've done town halls where it is at the same level, it's a particular format, because anything else from placement and ceremonial signals do say something. And so the more you are conscious about that, all the more you're saying what it is and what it is not. It comes from a simple design thinking process. And this is maybe me coming back from my architecture day. And you see this everywhere. So if you design a path, and if you notice then there is another path where people are treading on to get to the end destination, and maybe that's the right thing to do. And so from a culture piece, I think sometimes we do things like, oh, we must have town halls, or we must have ambassadors, or we have check-ins, etc. And when people are asking questions, and be very mindful, you could have people who are asking questions and they want to hear the right things, but they may not be exactly the things that is happening. So make sure that you have enough people who are close to the ground, network leaders, who are not necessarily the ones in an organization, but who are plugged in, understand what's going on and have the true sense of the organization to be able to counter and sensitize leaders. Because sometimes, you know what, in an organization, there'll be people who also want leaders to see what they should be seeing. And we could be packaging information to say, well, yes, a certain percentage of people are distracted. However, majority of people are on board. So I will question, what do you say my majority? I will walk the ground, I have lunches, etc. And I'm mindful, I will be coming from a place of seniority. So empower people who be part of your team and get them to say, hey, so break out, gather together. What are you saying? What are you hearing? I think these are things that you could do to consciously influence and consciously influence, hoping to get to the right direction. One example, like I said, you can have a town hall and you want to hear what people are saying. But when you have a town hall, and the way you ceremoniously even stand and have people stand and start is already saying something. And people are just sensing about what culture is, etc. So be very clear as to what you want to say, mm-hmm. but what you don't want to say.
Got it. What
signals, badges, locations, corner offices, mm-hmm. Attire. And I like to think I'm casual, but when we had clearly a startup organization, casual, in my opinion, was seen even as formal for somebody else. And I had people in the stores who sometimes call me Mr. Dylan Chong, and I'm like, ooh, is this a level of formality? And like, no, that's not the case. And you don't give people an opportunity to make stuff up. And so just be proactively telling what it is and what it is not.
Got it. And always, I mean, what I'm hearing is be networking on the ground. If you can't do it because you're at a seniority level and there would be certain things which come up because you're senior, get your network leaders, people who are at different levels of the organization, to really keep the pulse on what's actually happening with people and what are their concerns and what's happening with majority of the workforce.
I'll give you an example in the hotel industry. I mm-hmm. typically always say it is not the GM or the XCOM that's the most important. Speak to the people when I was keeping or the stewards. Join mm-hmm. them during lunch times or when I'm about to go home. The most amazing stories and the litmus test is there. And case in point, if a GM takes a leave for, say, 2 to 3 months, the hotel doesn't stop. But if housekeeping, all of them say they're going to stop for an hour, you have
an issue. The hotel stops, yeah.
So technically, they are the most important people. We just need to remind ourselves that.
Absolutely. Look, I have another question, which is more related to talent acquisition here, which is about how Adidas is going about talent acquisition in such a competitive market right now.
Good question. Well, at least with the remit and this part of the world where I'm at, we've just had a restructure of Asia Pacific. So the Asia Pacific headquarters for Adidas is shifting from Shanghai to Singapore. And this is also the location for the APAC headquarters, the Southeast Asia hub headquarters, as well as the Singapore commercial business. To be fair, with a brand name like Adidas, I think for me, at least from a TA or talent acquisition perspective, it is already a foot in the door compared to some organizations which are smaller in size or are less well-known. But I think what we are trying to do is to also make sure that when we are recruiting for people, I don't want to necessarily assume that people actually understand what Adidas is doing and why it's doing. You will see collaterals like that available out there. So when we do our quarterly release or our fire strategies, it's available out there. There are press releases, there are videos, etc. But making sure that sometimes we articulate it to the talent pool is so important. Mm-hmm. Because the first thing you think about Adidas is obviously, ooh, sports, lifestyle, shoes. And that could be very far and very different from the role that we're hiring for.
Yeah.
Sometimes connecting the two together in opportunities when you are talking to people to clarify the why at the initial stages is always very useful. And I also have the privilege and luxury of having an in-house talent acquisition team, and they're really well trained. But I think if I want to look at being smart about being a talent acquirer, it's really firing our engines in all grounds. Case in point, I think yesterday was a holiday in Singapore, Visak Day, and I was talking to the head of talent acquisition for APAC. Let's explore returnships. So we have internships, we have management trainees, we have full-time roles. And I said, well, the realities of today, given the pandemic, we are going to be so short-sighted if we do not even explore a hidden talent pool. So people who may be hoping to return to the workforce because they've had time off, but it's a sabbatical, or moms who've had time away from the workforce because family was a priority, or even dads for that matter. I don't want to stereotype. And here, then the strategies as to how you approach them, obviously, I'm not just going to sell Adidas. Obviously, I'm not just going to sell the role, but what truly matters with this talent pool, flexible hours, an ability to give them an opportunity to come back to the workforce with the same number of challenge. I think it's about tweaking the messaging firing all engines of talent pools that we have never explored. Look, I'm going back to the schools to look at, these are the hires of tomorrow. I'm partnering with our search partners who are obviously doing many things, and any possible way of getting the name out there and having an opportunity for people to connect is one touch point. And this is what I tell the acquisition team, all my leaders, as well as the HR team in general. I suppose today, if you ask me, is there one true strategy that's going to differentiate Adidas? Well, everybody today is looking for talents. But I suppose looking at talents to varying degrees. I think some companies are playing it safe to say, let's hold and see, the situation is not great. I stay true to the fact that we like to invest in our people who are already in our organization today and ensuring that we prepare them for them to be ever ready for the future workforce of tomorrow. That's number one. Number two, I'm constantly looking at people who are not quite the prototype. Like, you don't necessarily have to have this type of experience or history. I'm looking at competencies. As long as you can get it done, you're a potential talent. So reframing my internal folks to make sure that we broaden our understanding of talent, how we hire, at the same time making sure that we get ourselves out there. Look, I'm not pitching myself against other sports companies or retailers. Clearly, even in Singapore, for example, in the most recent employer rankings on Straits Time, I'm pitching myself to the best of the best, like the Apples of the world, the Googles of the world, because look, all is fair in love and war as well as talent. So if I'm competing myself against a retailer or a service competitor, I'm going to sell myself short. So it's widening the perspective as to what talents and where talents are, and really making sure that we have a very future forward way of looking at how we bring people in would be some of the strategies that we're putting in place.
Yeah, and I love the whole idea behind, you know, moving from a prototype of this is how the person should be to really expand it and include people from all different areas, whether there's university students or people who are coming back from a sabbatical, moms who are returning to work. That's commendable. And a lot of time, people who've been out of work for a while and they are trying to return, they want to prove to themselves and the others that they're really good at things and they're back in it for the long haul. So this is truly an untapped or undertapped market, so to speak. So I wish this really kicks off very well for you. So I'm going to switch gears from talent acquisition to something else. Earlier, when we talked about some challenges you loved solving, you talked about how with the whole digital transformation, e-commerce and omnichannel wave, one of the situations which started coming up was that very young professionals were leading global teams of more experienced people. So I'm wondering, how did you approach leadership development, especially in an ascription-based culture we see in Asia, where age, rank, seniority, all these things matter a lot? And how was the overall experience like?
I love to use my example in Sephora. Because by the time I was in Sephora, I would have been exposed to a truly wider gamut of what I think leadership development offerings are like in the market. Because I would have spent enough time in the industry to be able to say, yep, I think this is what is appropriate at different levels. Boy, was I wrong. because the business mandate was the fact that, yeah, it could be a young 26-year-old who's going to be the chief talent officer or chief tech officer, etc. The reality of it is that they have the right technical skill sets. And if you think about it, leadership is not about a technical skill set. Leadership is about being able to inspire, being able to motivate, give a sense of direction. And you don't have to report to somebody for you to develop leadership skill sets. Case in point, if you look at global leaders all over the world, we are not connected to them. We're not in the same location, but we're drawn to their point of view, why they do certain things, etc. And that to me, that's what leadership is. And what I was able to do was to say, look, there are clearly certain things that need to be appropriate at different levels of seniority. And I was very clear. So if you are starting off, you know, so the price of entry is probably you being able to do the technical skill sets really well. If I'm hiring a coding engineer, know your codes, know your language, etc. By the time you become a manager of managers, it's about being able to look at managerial skill sets. What is it to manage a budget, discipline, hire people? And many people get very confused between managerial skill sets and leadership skill sets. And for me, demystifying that was very important. Demystifying that even at the leadership level is very important. And then coming up with curriculum, which in the past are completely ascribed to a level of seniority, I threw that out of the window. I began to equate the skill sets being needed in roles which require leadership skill sets. because we think that leaders, I think that's a bit of a stereotype. Leaders are senior, leaders are high ranking. I have a very differing viewpoint. Yes, in a lot of organizations, the two would parallel one another. But for me, case in point, leadership is about a point of view, is about being able to direct, motivate, and inspire others, and putting the fire in people's hearts and minds. And it exists at different levels and different roles. And so putting people who need to therefore learn leadership development like that, and then putting them in the room, then clearly tells you then you may not have a room of senior people.
Mm-hmm.
And the beauty of it is sometimes I have seen this in several sessions. So when you have a bunch of senior folks and you bring in leadership development, they tend to say the same things. And it's just an affirmation of what they already know, but perhaps in a framework. Try putting someone who is very senior and next to somebody who less senior from a tenure perspective, but no less important from a leadership perspective, you get very diverse viewpoints. And I think that's just so important because, look, today we're probably having 4 to 5 generations in one organization. But the people that I'm ascribing leadership development to who are first-time leaders are going to be leaders of the future. And they're learning from two things. Number one, the same frameworks that will be ascribed to somebody who's senior today. And they're actually learning from those who are senior today as to what they've done and what are the pitfalls. And then, not just taking wholesale what is prescribed in a curriculum or what the people before them have done, they are very quick to articulate their own point of view from their own experiences and say, great framework, great learning experiences mm-hmm. from others, but this is my own viewpoint. And I think leadership development is about developing your own point of view and how you draw others to you and how you get other people to believe in the same cause as you. And that has nothing to do with age or seniority. And those are some of the things that I've done. And I was very happy I was able to do some of that in Sephora. And to be fair, I may be a bit biased, but I had more fun facilitating to those folks than the traditional senior set.
Yeah, so they come up with their dynamic energy, which can be very infectious as well for the organizations.
They answer hardest questions and they're not afraid to ask questions. They explore mm-hmm. dimensions and are not afraid to go into places or dimensions where you typically don't think you want to go to. And it challenges me even as a facilitator. So I get to up my level. And the thing is, I want to make sure that if I were to facilitate or share with folks leadership development, that I have to be current as well. So that's my way of staying current, to be fair.
Absolutely. Look, if somebody is rising to the position of chief technology officer at 26, that person is very competent. It's just about, you know, channeling that competence in a way that this person can become a future leader and develops the leadership skills along the way. So definitely a bright person if they've reached that level so soon. So look, you know, leadership is one aspect, but I'm also going to touch up on employee engagement and retention, especially because you personally and the organizations you have led over the years have won many awards on both employee engagement and retention. So can you share with us some important strategies which you always focus on or some examples from your career on how you improve the engagement?
I've actually learned now that when we want to engage people, so engagement is such a big concept, but there are many things that drive engagement, and hence anybody who's in the field will understand what are drivers of engagement. I think managers play a big role in making sure that people are engaged. The purpose and the work that you do drives a level of fulfillment. Access to information, resources, and tools are important. So anybody who's practicing engagement will understand that these are the key dimensions. And as long as you have sufficient interventions across these areas as to what makes it meaningful an employee, you tend to drive an overall healthy level of engagement. So there's really nothing new around this area. For me, my personal learning has always been that if you think about it from a benefits perspective, right, it is truly never a benefit to me unless it means something to me. And so the thing with engagement is that you want to do engagement that sort of hits the organization across, because obviously as a strategist, you want to keep maximum impact. Mm-hmm. But today, engagement clearly is very individual. Look, you could throw me diamonds and 1,000,001 things that you think are good for the organization, but what matters to me as an individual needs to be touched upon. And so here, I think that is a fascinating relationship between HR, the employee, and the direct manager, and how we sort of manifest and nurture that. For me, the organizations where I've had the most level of success is where HR was able to demystify itself. I've seen in countless organizations when HR is in the room, the reaction is, ooh, HR is in the room. Or the VP HR, ooh, be very mindful. And the organizations where I know I was hitting the right note is where I walk into the room and everybody's like, hey, Dylan, welcome. we'd love to have you here, etc. So to me, it's not about the numbers anymore. So engagement scores are engagement scores. I've learned to read between the lines as to what that means when I'm able to read and sense and pulse in such soft and beautiful ways. That's number one. And number two, today, there are many things that we could begin to tear apart as being archaic. So for example, and these are some examples in past organizations. So in the service industry, for example, you spend so much time sometimes hiring a person. And in the first 3 months, technically, you cannot claim on your benefits or you can't apply for leave, etc. And these are practices which we've inherited over time. And sometimes people think that's the right thing to do. And I've just gone into a space of saying that's completely ridiculous and out of this world. Like, they are an employee, and maybe this is touching upon the dimension of inclusion. Like, they should have same access, rights, and equity like a normal employee would do. But we don't. We don't. And we give ourselves a million and one reasons to say, well, they're not confirmed yet as employees, or we need more time, or the fact that the longer an employee stays in the organization, the more benefits they need to get, or benefits which are ascribed to senior roles. I think seniors, people in a senior organization, people senior in organization will be compensated differently. So you have a different salary. But I think things like benefits, access and equity, I don't think anybody who is in a, if I were to use an example of a store, somebody working in a store should have the same benefits and access rights to somebody who's an MD of a business, because they're both people. Mm-hmm. And in organizations where I dispelled the myth, I had people coming back to say, you actually understand what it means to be human and understand what it means to speak to me as an employee, because you're not saying that the MD is more important, that we're both important, it's just that we do different jobs. I think engagement happens at that level. Engagement is where you speak to people, you connect to people, and not just initiatives or engagement scores, or those are needed. Don't get me wrong, those are very much needed. But if you want to have a truly inspired and engaged organization, is making sure that you have broad enough strategies to cover everybody, but you have enough tenacity and space to go to the individual. And then when you do that, and if you do it well both ways, trust me, your entire organization would lift this engagement levels up. And you can tell when the workforce is engaged. You don't need an engagement score to tell you that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I love the word human. So, you know, putting human in human resources as one of the logos of working and, you know, looking at your employees as humans first. So thank you for sharing that story with us, Dylan. You've had a very fascinating career over the years. I have a couple of questions before we end this. The first one is, which skills, technical or soft skills, are most important, according to you, for a professional to get into senior level leadership role?
And this is regardless of whether I'm in HR or not, right? Just a senior leadership roles.
Yeah.
Okay. I think relationship building is important. Mm-hmm. At senior levels, the premium on technical skill set and manager's skill sets obviously are less important. Okay. I think so when you go into leadership roles, there are certain key competencies which are important. I think relationship building is one, because while it may not be things that make you successful, it will be something that derails you if you don't do well.
Mm-hmm.
Emotional intelligence is so key. The ability to be self-aware and manage yourself and manage others. And I think in such times when the world is increasingly becoming more volatile and complex and things are needed fast and resources are getting lean, the ability to have shorter fuses or the ability not to connect with people emotionally and be people's emotional compass becomes a premium skill set, in my opinion. I feel cognitive complexity is important. I mean, the ability to make very complex information simple for people to understand is an important skill set. The ability to abstract, distill so many data points and say, but this is what I'd like you to understand, and make it really simple for people to get. And then last but not least, I think the ability to influence, because ultimately in leadership roles, look, if you have the Knights of the Round Table, I suppose the reason why you have a sit at the table is because you are an expert in an area or a dimension, and therefore that grants you your seat.
Yeah.
But everybody else has gotten to the table the same way. And so then it is about being able to, through the skill sets that I mentioned earlier, relationship building, emotional intelligence, etc., looking at complex information and then influencing people and aligning people. I think these are skill sets and competencies that we're all aware, but increasingly for me, important. And there's something that's very fascinating for me today, because I think the word VUCA has been around for a long time.
Yeah.
It's not new anymore, but we're seeing it come to life with the COVID pandemic, and it's completely brought this skill set as one that is important. Today, I'm of the opinion that if you have leaders who are able to operate with complex situation where you may not get 100% of the data, mm-hmm. but you get sufficient enough information, a data point, for you to be able to react quickly and make a quick call and fail, try fast, fail fast, mm-hmm. is an emerging skill set today.
Yeah.
And I think this is clearly important as we become more digitalized, as more organizations want to transform. It may have been present in previous competency speak like agility, etc. But agility manifesting itself in a way where I will get very late information in fragmented forms and in ways that I don't like, or mm-hmm. in fashion where I'm not familiar with, but the ability to still operate within such constraints is an emerging skill set. So these are some of the things which I think have been important over time, and some emerging skill sets which I think are increasingly becoming a premium.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think this concept of failing, you know, a few years down the line, not a lot of organizations used to embrace it, but we see more and more organizations, especially with the whole digital wave, having the concept of try out new things, even if you fail, try fast, fail fast, has been the motto for those organizations as well. So Dylan, now you have had a remarkable career so far, and I'm sure that you will be gaining even greater heights in the years to come. And you have played a very active role in the business throughout, you know, your career, whether it was with Starwood, it was with Sephora, or now currently with Adidas. So what advice would you give to people entering HR workforce to be able to have an exciting career like yourself?
I think HR is clearly evolving. I wasn't trained in HR. My earlier groundings was in architecture. I went into HR eventually because there's something about the discipline that fascinated me. And today, look, there's so much research out there that says HR is never going to be the same in, say, 15 to 20 years. And HR as a function is both a function that has a lot of science to it, but it's a lot of art to it as well. It is, which is why maybe some people call it a softer function. And the reason why I go into it is because, unlike other business functions where you have an input and you can almost identify what's an output, in HR, the amplification is sometimes uncertain. The variability mm-hmm. that you're dealing with people and organizations, because they're complex, will not mean that 1 + 1 = 2. Mm-hmm. So I love playing that field. But I suppose anybody who wants to go into HR, be very mindful that it is not going to be the sexiest of our functions, but it's the most gratifying, because I have a feeling that people outlive organizations, and people find meanings in what they do in their careers. And I was able to find that myself at a very early stage when I went into HR. Today, if you put me in front of a room, that's always going to be my passion point, because that's just how I started in HR. I started in learning development, and something in me just ticked, the light bulb just ticked. And many years later, through my own evolved experiences, I was very glad that I came upon the framework of, and there's a Japanese word to it, it's ikigai, it's the reason for being. So it is about a mix of what you love, what you're good at, what the world organization needs, plus what you can be paid for. Mm-hmm. So if you put four circles beautifully, and if you're right smack in the middle, that's where you know that that's your calling. That's where you know then that it is not a job, because the moment you feel it's a job, then time passes very slowly. But and the adage is that if you love what you do, then it is not like a job anymore. Mm-hmm. Ikigai was a concept and a framework that I completely love and I completely prescribe. And only go into HR if this is where your ikigai is. Mm-hmm. Because it's going to be that one function that always doesn't get its credit all the time. It's always going to be the function which is seen as an enabler. Some mm-hmm. organizations call it back-end function. I don't know what that means, and I don't even know why. But you're dealing with humans, and there are so many variations to that term now. So HR, in fact, in itself, a naming convention, which is also archaic, right? Human and resources. Mm-hmm. So people have gone into human capital, etc. But the essence of it is that you're dealing with people, and organizations are made up of people. And so there's an element of me. I may be logical, structured, and I am a thinker. So if you go into certain profiling tools, I may not necessarily be top of mind when it comes to, oh, he hates the people function. Mm-hmm. But there's so many aspects of HR that strikes me and make me excited and continue to excite me. And so if you haven't had a chance, do a quick search online. Search Ikigai.
I come across that. I've read the book. So I'm aware of the whole Ikigai concept. And it's a great book.
So you get me. And so if you have time this weekend, read the book, either buy the book or get an ebook, and then maybe apply it to yourself. So if you're a young professional or somebody who wants to switch your game into HR, ask yourself whether the function of HR fits you and whether it is your ikigai. And speak to as many people as possible. Walk a mile in their shoes or take a returnship or an externship or an internship, whatever you call it these days. Realistic job preview and then find out whether it is for you. And if it's for you, it's never going to be another day's worth of work. And that's all I can say.
Wow, that speaks highly of HR. If it's for you, then you won't be working another day of your life. So thank you so much, Dylan, for sharing so generously with us, giving us all the stories and examples from your career. To all our viewers, if you've enjoyed this podcast, please give us a like. Please do remember to follow Dylan. His LinkedIn profile is linked to this post, so you can just go ahead and follow him and see what other exciting things he does with his career. Thank you very much, Dylan, for your time today.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to go to www.alcottglobal.com and click the podcast button for all the show notes of the interview. Also, subscribe to our mailing list to get our latest update first. If you are listening to a streaming platform like iTunes, Spotify, or Stitcher, we would appreciate a kind review. 5 stars work best to keep us going and our production team happy. And of course, share it with your friends. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me. And if you have any suggestions on what to do or who to invite next, don't hesitate to drop me a note. And if you're looking to hire top executives in supply chain or transform your business, of course, contact us as well to find out how we can help.